Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. Well, it says on air and stream left. Yeah.
I guess we hope she logs in early enough to make use of the hour.
I wonder if we had a time zone difference in communication. Or something has happened to her. I'm going to do a screenshot. And I think my keyboard doesn't play nicely with the Mac, and so I'm constantly having to adjust. Nope, that's not it. I did screenshots before, and I don't remember how I did it.
Command, Shift, and 4.
Yeah, my keyboard doesn't have command.
Oh, yeah, you did that. I'm sorry.
There. That. Nope, that's not it. Oh, I'm using a different keyboard. I'm not using the keyboard on the Mac. I'm using a... But I'll do that. Maybe that's what I have to do. You said command, then what? Shift?
Command, Shift, and 4.
Nope. You mean F4?
No, the number 4.
Yeah, try that.
It'd be different on our keyboards.
Oh. Oh, well. My screen's not that exciting.
No worries.
Well, do you want to talk about the limitations of the VSPID app? I'm kidding.
This is funny.
Mm-hmm. So what was happening is when I tried to call in 15 minutes ahead, it said, you know, option 1 is to start your recording now, and option 2 is to listen to critical news or information. So I'm like, okay, fine, I'll listen to critical information. It wasn't that critical. It was stuff I already knew. And then the audio takes me right back into option 1 is to start your recording now, or option 2 is to listen to the same information. And I was like, I don't want to start. Like, I was afraid it was going to start the recording ahead of the scheduled time. If I push that button, but it didn't. It just let me into the recording studio.
That would wake me up too, though. I would hesitate to push that button.
My husband and okay. I kind of have this running. I tend to be pretty literal when it comes to instructions, and so I have this series of little things in our life that I'm like, well, you know, if the instructions said it this way,
I have the same. I look at the way that things are worded, and I'm like, this could be interpreted a couple different ways. They need to be more specific.
Oh, thanks, Heather. Wrong.
Oh.
Heather is here.
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Heather.
Hello.
This is Kathy. Brittany, I'm going to go ahead and mute you, unless you have anything
to
say.
Yes, perfect. No, please do.
Okay. Have you had a chance to catch your breath, Heather?
I have.
Coming from something else.
I have. Can you hear me all right? I'm on my microphone. I'm hard of hearing, so I use headphones and a microphone.
Oh, yes, I can hear you. How about,
okay.
Are you able to hear
Perfect.
Me?
I am, yes.
Okay. Well, we are recording now, so to speak. I don't want to say live because it's not streaming live, but we are recording at this point, so we can edit out this little preliminary stuff. But it will cut us off promptly at the top of the hour.
No problem.
And I forgot to mention to you, I will also record an intro and an outro separate from this. So that's where I'll introduce you more meaningfully than I am right now. So
no problem.
If it's okay with you, we can jump into the questions.
That sounds great.
Okay. Here we go. So your paper focuses on the vSPIDAT tool, and that's an acronym for the Vulnerability Index Service Prioritization Decision Assistance Tool. And the vSPIDAT, we know, is used in many communities to triage, screen, and prioritize individuals and families for various types of housing assistance. So I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about what you learned about the development of this tool and what the original intention was behind its creation.
The Vulnerability Index, the VI, was developed by Community Solutions based on the work of Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless program to assess an individual's risk for mortality. And that informed decisions about prioritizing scarce housing resources. So it's first important to understand that the tool was developed to assess needs among the chronically homeless. And this early work found that factors associated with heightened risk included things like multiple hospitalizations or ER visits, being over age 60, cirrhosis of the liver, et cetera. In other words, the tool was not intended to assess risk among survivors of domestic and sexual violence. So the second part of the vSPIDAT, the Service Prioritization Decision Assistance Tool, was developed by Oracle Code Consulting as a more in-depth assessment tool to further consider the socioeconomic and psychosocial risk factors related to homelessness. And these tools were combined to create the vSPIDAT, designed for a rapid interview-style administration. The ultimate goal of the assessment is to move individuals and families into safe, permanent, and sustainable housing. But it's important to mention here that while HUD-mandated COCs use a consistent assessment process, HUD did not mandate the vSPIDAT specifically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. That was really helpful overview there. So in terms of the vSPIDAT tool, then break down the science for us in the sense that, you know, your paper, you outlined some research that indicated there were some challenges and limitations with this particular tool. So can you explain your findings and tell us, what does it mean? Why should we care about what you've learned?
The tool is an interview-style assessment tool, which has items across a number of domains, including history of housing and homelessness, risks, socialization and daily functioning, wellness and family. And then they create a global score that is used to compare people's needs as determined by those questions. And to date, only one published study has examined the reliability and validity of the vSPIDAT to assess whether it's performing as desired. So for those of you who aren't trained in research methods, reliability is how consistently a tool is working. In this case, how consistently the tool is measuring risk within individuals over time, consistency across those doing the scoring, and consistency across COCs nationally, for that matter. Validity is whether the tool is measuring what we think it is measuring, or how well the tool is measuring an individual or family's actual housing needs. So in 2018, Brown and colleagues published a study of data from a Midwestern COC's HMIS database, and it included almost 1,500 single adults experiencing homelessness. They found that the tool had poor test-retest quality, with most participants scoring higher the more times they were assessed with the tool. The researchers also found that the tool had poor inter-rater reliability, which means that the same client was scored differently depending on who was conducting the assessment. They also looked at how well the tool predicted reentry into homelessness services over time and did not find that it performed well. In addition to these factors from this one study, domestic and sexual violence advocates have pointed out that the tool is not particularly trauma-informed and does not accurately capture the experiences of survivors that might shape their risk for homelessness. So given all of these factors, if the tool is not performing consistently, then it's not really resulting in equitable decision-making about scarce resources. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's... That sums it up well. And, you know, given these issues in terms of the consistency of what it's trying to measure and, you know, is it actually getting at the right concepts, you know, many communities have turned to the vSPIDAT because they're really seeking a simple, in a consistent way to try to assess individuals and families. And I think you've just talked about some of this consistency is problematic. But we know communities are really looking for an objective and an unbiased method to do this sort of assessment for getting people into limited housing resources. But in your paper, you know, you pointed out several ways that bias is still influencing how housing resources are allocated, even when people are using this VSPIDAT tool. And so, you know, I think for communities, it's a bit of kind of a head scratcher. They're feeling like VSPIDAT should be standardized. And you've just talked about how, you know, some limitations with the way it's not very standard. But tell us how can there still be bias and subjectivity when a tool like this is really intended to streamline people's housing instability situations and really trying to streamline them into a numeric score? I think there's a sense that a numeric score should be objective. So tell us how there can still be bias and subjectivity in a tool like this.
Absolutely. I think we think that if we are all asking the same questions, we are getting the same information from clients and making the same decisions. And why understanding the reliability and validity of a tool is so important is because it helps us understand that that's not actually the case. So when a tool doesn't have strong reliability and validity, it opens up the door for potential bias to shape how resources are allocated, even when that's not the intention, because none of us go into this work thinking that we're going to make different decisions for different people. A recent study from Oregon, Virginia, and Washington found that Black, Indigenous, and people of color were 32% less likely than their white counterparts to receive a high prioritization score, despite their overrepresentation in the coordinated entry system. So this could be related to unconscious or conscious bias of the interviewer. It's also shaped by community priorities, funding decisions, and federal mandates. Together, these findings suggest that the implementation of the VSPIDAT has the potential for coordinated entry assessment to exacerbate inequities in homelessness, especially for communities of color.
Sorry, I was on mute. So you just spoke to some of this, but I want to give you also a chance to perhaps speak to it again in a different way if you want. So here's my next question. Besides finding that the VSPIDAT isn't trauma-informed and doesn't capture survivors' experience as well, you mentioned that there are also some other problematic aspects about how communities are using the VSPIDAT and things that are related to how it's administered. So what are some other critical considerations for communities who are really weighing the concerns about whether they should continue with the VSPIDAT scoring tool or move on to something else?
Thanks for that great question. The limitations of the VSPIDAT are compounded by potential challenges with implementation. Providers are trained to administer the tool, but turnover in staff, caseload, and other factors might shape how the assessment is conducted. Moreover, it's difficult to have a trauma-informed conversation if the questions providers are expected to ask are not trauma-informed themselves. There's also a variability in funding models across the United States, and this is something I learned when I started speaking with providers in different regions of the country about how they use the VSPIDAT. And these funding models shape how risk assessment translates to connecting survivors to needed services. So, for example, in some communities, like Multnomah County in Oregon, there are dedicated resources for domestic and sexual violence survivors. So assessment happens in the DV agencies, and a team comes together to help match survivors to needed housing. In other communities that don't have those separate funding streams, survivors are compared against other populations seeking housing. And so depending on community priorities and how the assessment process happens, this might disadvantage survivors as the tool doesn't accurately capture their unique vulnerabilities and needs for housing. So unique vulnerabilities for survivors might include problems with credit because an abuser has run up a credit card bill or things like that that are unique to survivors' experiences.
Thank you. So I think we've covered a great deal around this particular tool and the different limitations, the ways that bias is still very much prevalent in its application, and also, you know, you've outlined some of the implementation challenges with it. So, you know, some of these limitations are pretty well documented at this point, and I'd like to turn our attention to other sorts of tools that communities could use to assess risk and help prioritize survivors for housing. And so in your paper, you talked about a couple of other approaches being used in some communities. Could you give us a quick sketch about those other approaches?
The danger assessment is an example of a tool that's often used to supplement the VA-SPDAT, and it was initially developed in 1986 for health and social service providers to initiate safety planning and promote survivor empowerment by identifying risk for intimate partner homicide. So there have been studies showing that the tool does moderately predict future harm, but it was not designed to inform decisions about housing. And that's really important here. Sometimes service providers assume that survivors need to leave their homes, but that might not be the best choice or the choice that makes sense for every survivor. So a more in-depth assessment to truly understand the constellation of risks survivors experience would be helpful. Another study, a very recent study, introduced a tool called the Survivors Achieving Stable Housing Tool, and it included a self-referral form, which took about 30 to 45 minutes to complete, so it's certainly more extensive than the VA-SPDAT, and a referral to be completed by a domestic and sexual violence advocate. This tool emerged from concerns about the VA-SPDAT, but it's lengthy, and the outcomes are really dependent on the provider. Multnomah County, which I mentioned earlier, also has a more extensive tool that captures the constellation of survivor experiences, though to my knowledge, empirical research hasn't been conducted to really understand the tool's ability to predict housing outcomes. But a big question that comes from these more extensive tools is how they're woven into funding models that compare survivors to others with housing needs to make decisions about allocation of resources. So there's certainly a need to reconceptualize assessment, but also in the context of conversations about broader funding structures.
You've also seen the first paper in our special series, which suggests using a decision tree as an alternative to the VSPDAT sort of scoring tool. So I'm curious to hear from you, in what ways does this alternative process, this decision tree, in what ways does this address some of the shortcomings that are inherent in the VSPDAT scoring tool?
From my perspective, the decision tree really highlights the power of having more in-depth conversations with our clients about their experiences to truly understand their needs. So let me use my experience in the healthcare system as an example. In that space, we've shifted from a screening model for domestic violence to an assessment model. In other words, instead of going through a checklist to determine what supports a survivor might need, we open up the door for a broader conversation rather than pushing for disclosure. Because it takes survivors time to feel comfortable sharing their experiences, and this is not like anyone who is experiencing homelessness. So an assessment approach helps build trust between the client and the survivor, and that allows the potential to see if other resources might keep someone housed. And it really helps the provider have as much information as possible to make a truly informed decision. So I'm very excited to see the same approach applied to housing.
Thank you. That was really helpful to help us frame this shift that we are proposing, the shifting from screening to an assessment approach. As you know, we've received a couple questions from some of our partners who are involved with our organization, the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence. We're involved with the Domestic Violence and Housing Technical Assistance Consortium. And so a couple questions from our partners have come in, and I just wanted to read these to you and get your thoughts. One of our partners asks or mentions that there's a tension that exists for programs that are funded by HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department. And this tension that programs that are funded by HUD is that they focus on data and measurement of priority need. And it comes up in local communities' coordinated entry processes, and also when they apply for competitive funding, where they have to demonstrate success in how they've allocated their previous housing resources. So given that local programs feel this tension and this need to focus on data and measurement, what measure do you think can be used to show that a particular survivor should have the one and only housing unit available at a given time? How would you address that?
I really appreciate this tension. And right now, there's no one measure or tool that will address all of these challenges. Brown's paper from 2018 highlights that the VISPADAT is not successful in predicting housing outcomes and predicting success. And honestly, this is where we started with this project with the VISPADAT. We were interested in creating a more trauma-informed tool, but it became very apparent that we couldn't simply swap out the tool without addressing broader structural issues in the system. We will need to work together, domestic and sexual violence advocates, housing experts, to think about the system comprehensively to get at your very question. I keep thinking about, are there additional funding models that can help ease this tension? I know this is not a satisfying answer, because even in other areas, in healthcare, for example, providers ask me, what is that one question that I need to ask my clients to understand what they're experiencing? And there isn't one question. And so that's why I think moving to an assessment and really starting to more comprehensively understand our clients' experiences will help us make decisions that are equitable across the system.
Well, thank you for giving kind of a really direct and honest response to that. And that underscores, I think, the challenges. And what it brings up for me is a sense of the fallacy of us trying to predict success when we're talking about complex human beings and complex sorts of needs. So I think that's a point well taken. So another question that we received from one of our partners is similar, but it gets at how might a guided conversation like the decision tree that we've recommended and that you just spoke about, how might a guided conversation such as the decision tree be codified and its results documented in order to provide justification for a housing map? Do you have thoughts about that?
What's so interesting to me about the guided conversation is that in many ways you gather similar information you would have if you proceeded with a screening tool, but you gather the information in a more trauma-informed way. And let us be clear that even if clients aren't accessing the system through domestic and sexual violence agencies, it doesn't mean they haven't experienced trauma. So I do think it's important to think about how anyone that we're working with who is seeking housing resources might have experienced trauma, and this process is certainly exacerbating what they've experienced. So having these in-depth conversations are more trauma-informed, and it really opens up the door for problem-solving that might kind of allow us to identify other alternatives than housing. It's, perhaps they need, I know I've heard my colleagues talk about flexible funding that might provide survivors or others with, the ability to address some of their short-term needs that will allow them to stay in their homes. And so, having these in-depth conversations helps us identify some of those alternatives. And I'll defer to the team who led the development of the decision tree regarding their recommendations for scoring, but I do recommend investing in future research to understand how a broader assessment of risk can predict housing outcomes. I'm very encouraged and excited to think about how this decision tree can help us make decisions.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Thanks. I think you spoke to this before, but just to give you another swing at it, if you'd like, I'll raise another question here for you. This isn't highlighted a whole lot in your paper, but I know that you did learn some interesting things about different funding models that are used in different communities across the country. And so I'm hoping you can share a little bit about these different approaches to funding. And how they shape the coordinated entry process and the implications for assessing survivors' needs.
Yeah, this really came up when it became very clear that we couldn't just swap out a tool and address all of the needs of survivors and other clients seeking housing. I spent time in Portland, Oregon, speaking with the Multnomah folks about their model, which does have separate funding for survivors who need housing. And so because we know that there is not enough supply to meet the demand, these separate funding streams prevented the system from kind of pitting one person against the other, so pitting survivors against others who are also seeking housing. And so I think that was, it allowed for a more in-depth assessment of their trauma histories and connecting them to resources. But in many places around the country, those funding models don't exist. So everyone is competing for those scarce resources. And it became difficult to think about swapping out a tool or using a tool that is just focused on trauma in some of those models where everyone is being considered for those scarce housing resources. And so that just underscores the need for us to come together, those who do work with domestic and sexual violence and those who are housing experts, to think about how we can work together to create a trauma-informed system that addresses all of the needs of our clients.
Okay. Your paper concludes with a brief discussion about how to start moving forward. And we know, because we hear from lots of communities all across the country, that they're eager and they're ready to adopt new tools and new processes. Like many folks understand the limitations of the VSPIDAD, and I think your paper really adds to their knowledge around that and strengthens their resolve to shift to something else. We've talked about how we can't just immediately jump to some other scoring process because it's not trauma-informed and for all the reasons you've talked about. So help us talk to those communities who are ready to change. We know that the way that they go about this and the conversations that they're having are super, super important. So what guidance do you have from them? You know, what should communities keep in mind as they really explore and think about a kind of new and improved approaches to assessing risk and prioritizing housing resources?
As I've mentioned, I think it's exciting to think about the possibility of us coming together. And I know that this work that you all are leading is already happening. And it's really been an honor for me to come to the table and work with others in the housing community and those who are experts in that particular area to think about these challenges together. So I think we need to be thinking about this from a structural perspective. So not only recognizing the limitations of the tool and thinking about how we do assessment, but having those conversations at the same time that we're having questions about the funding models and the implementation concerns that I mentioned earlier. So we can't just create a new tool without thinking about how it is implemented in a community, how training occurs, and how our systems unintentionally might exacerbate inequities. And so I think this now is the time to be having those conversations and to think about some of the ways that research can help answer those questions. One of the things in doing, you know, a review and understanding and getting to know the VSPIDAT is really recognizing the limitations in research that have been done with the tool so far. There just isn't a lot out there. And so, you know, this is also from my researcher hat on, this is a call to researchers to do more in-depth assessment of these tools to help inform evidence-based decision-making.
Thank you. I'm really hearing from you that since we can't just try to press one lever, we can't just try to solve the scoring issue, that, as you pointed out, we need to look at this in the context of all the structural aspects of coordinated entry and housing resources and looking at funding and implementation and racial bias and inequities. So I think that's
absolutely
helpful to be mindful that we can't just tweak one thing and expect it to have better results.
Exactly. And recognizing the power and need for taking a trauma-informed perspective to the work broadly, even if we don't think we're working with survivors, we are. There's so many experiences that the clients that we work with have never shared with us. And so I'm always a proponent of thinking about how a system as a whole can be more trauma-informed. So I look forward to those conversations as well.
Great. Thank you. Well, those are the questions that I prepped and tried to prioritize, but we still have time to record. So is there anything, you know, that I haven't really asked you that you do want to add to this conversation?
I don't think so. I mean, we kind of, I think we got, this paper was very narrowly focused on the VI SPDAT,
yeah.
The limitations of the tool itself. So, so I think this will be helpful in conjunction with some of the other papers in the series, which I look forward to spending more time reading. Because to your point, this is one lever.
I'm going to give you a chance to keep reflecting on that and also reflect on if there's anything else you want to redo. And then I'm going to also unmute Brittany for a second and see if she has any thoughts or observations or additional questions. So let me bring Brittany into this. She may not be listening. She might be multitasking. Brittany? Brittany? Hello, Brittany. Heather, are you still hearing me?
I am, yep.
Okay. She may have signed off. I know she has to go facilitate another meeting shortly. So I just thought I'd see
if
I'll keep her open.
The hardest questions here are the ones from your HUD partners, which I really appreciate. But I just like the decision tree. I mean, I think I haven't talked to Chris or Gabby about it, so I'm not sure what they were thinking. I am excited that it kind of helps us think about the shift from kind of a checklist screening tool towards assessment, but I'm not quite sure what they were thinking about regarding documentation and all of those things. So I can't really address those. I don't want to speak on behalf of them because I haven't talked to them.
I get it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I think this has been great. It's been really helpful.
If there's anything that you think I need to say again, I'm happy to jump back on at any point and record again.
That's helpful. No, I think you were really clear. I feel like some of my lead-ins too were a little messy, so I might redo a few of those. But other than that, I think we'll be good. I've taken notes too to add to the introduction and into the ending as well. So we'll tack those on to the beginning and into this. I don't know what the editing process will entail in terms of how long it's going to take and going back and forth.
Yeah,
I
no
do
problem.
Also know that we're planning on closed captioning for it as in addition to the audio recording. So
perfect.
Hopefully we'll get this turned around and out the door relatively quickly. And I just saw too that she's made the edits to the paper itself. So hopefully we'll get that reposted and all will be good.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was nice talking with you again. I appreciate
nice
the work and the way you've laid it out and the way that you've made it accessible to folks who are really wanting to take a critical look at this. So thanks.
No, I appreciate that. Measurement is the hardest thing to share with an audience who's not trained in research, I find. But it's, you know, so that's why I was like, okay, I need to explain what reliability and validity are. And I'm hoping that was at least clear enough that people can use what I shared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was helpful and easy to grasp. So thank you.
Perfect.
Okay. Well, thanks. I'm sure we'll be in touch in the future.
Sounds great. I look forward to it.
Okay. Thanks, Heather.
Bye.
Bye-bye.